This is an Odyssey original.
This is KNX In Depth. I'm Rob Archer.
I'm Charles Feldman. Gas prices getting awfully expensive, but didn't the state just create a department to try to control all of it? We go in depth into what's going on.
A bill in Sacramento looks to help Hollywood actors in their fight against the studios and AI. And more baby boomers are becoming homeless. We'll look into why.
We start with high gas prices and whether the state's new Division of Petroleum Market Oversight, sounds good, doesn't it? It has
like
a nice
sound
name.
Of that, yeah.
It has a good name. Should be doing something about it. Jamie Court is president of Consumer Watchdog, which was influential in getting this new division created. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, so it sounds impressive. Division of Petroleum Market Oversight. Is it doing anything? And if it is, how come the gas prices keep going up?
Well, it just got its new head. Ty Milder just started like 2 weeks ago, but it needs to get in high gear. We have a real problem with gas prices in the state. I've been following it. We've had, when our gas prices are like a more than $1.10 gap with U.S. gas prices, something's wrong. And we're up at $1.40 gap with U.S. gas prices, and it's grown every week by about a dime. We also know, because there's new reporting, that the refining margins, how much the refineries are making for every gallon of gas has grown. It was 66 cents per gallon they were making in profit in January, and now it's up to $1.20 in profit, so it's doubled.
So
There's something a matter. There's no question this market, there's a problem with this market.
It almost feels like as we have passed regulations, created this board, mm-hmm. the oil companies respond by finding reasons that the price has to go up.
Well, what we've found, and I've given this information to Ty and the Bureau, we found that their exports were very high this year. So they're exporting a lot of our gas. There's not a slowdown in production, but they have been exporting pretty consistently at a high level all year. And when that happens, they dry up the gas supply and the gas prices become higher and they can make more money from them. So I think it's time for us to impose this price gouging penalty that the state is authorized to impose, but hasn't begun the process of creating the rule making to do. I mean, this is really a warning shot for the state that if they don't get in high gear and put a regulation on the table so that they can take the money back when these refining margins get out of whack, then we are going to see more price hikes like we did last year. Last year, gas prices were $2.60 difference from the U.S. prices. Now they're $1.40, but they keep growing.
So, Jamie,
needs to happen quickly.
You said that we're exporting all of this gas. So what country do I have to go to fill up my car?
A lot of it's going to Central America. A lot of Central American gas is being exported this year. And with exports continuing to be high, obviously, when we have a changeover for the refineries to go to a new grade of gas, our gas becomes more scarce. So we've asked the Bureau to look into whether they're exporting into markets where they're not getting as good a price, because that's the key, right? If they're exporting because they can get a better price in Central America, then, that's free market economics. If they're exporting to Central America and not getting as good a price, then something's really the matter. And what's different this year, though, is we have someone who's now able to watch that kind of activity and to take action should he find that type of activity. And all the information that this law just passed the end of March, really April 1st. And so it is slow getting up and running. But we do have someone on the beat who's watching, who's listening. I don't know what he's going to do, but he's taking in the information we're giving him. And we do have the ability, as I said, to penalize refiners for profit margins that are too high once we create that rule. Now, they're talking about 6 months to create the rule. I think that's too long. But we are going down a road where this type of profiteering won't be allowed. And we can chart it now because this is the first year we've actually seen their refining margins month by month. And it's right there on the website for the California Energy Commission. We know it's $1.20 as of March that they're making per gallon.
right.
just in their own profits. And that is twice what it was in January.
All right. Jamie Court, thank you so much. President of Consumer Watchdog, trying to get that new division started, and it's working. Or is it the Division of Petroleum Market Oversight?
He said that the gas is being exported to Central America.
Central America.
Yes, I'm trying to do a calculation.
So how much gas it would take you to drive there to get gas?
Well, I'm trying to see if it's cheaper to go to my corner gas station,
right.
Which is in excess of $6 a gallon
wow.
now, or is it cheaper for me to put my car on a boat, send it to Central America,
right.
take a plane to Central America, meet up with my car, fill up the car with gas, and then repeat the process and come back? It may be cheaper.
It might be cheaper.
It might be cheaper.
At the very least, you break even.
Right now, though, a bill is being introduced in Sacramento that would help striking Hollywood actors deal with their concerns over artificial intelligence. With us now is the bill's author, Democratic Assemblymember Ash Cholera from San Jose. Thanks for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So tell us what this bill, if it becomes law, would do to help the striking actors.
So what this bill would do is really focus on contracts that kind of transfer the rights to a performer's digital self to the studios, and it essentially protects an individual's likeness, image, voice from contracts that will take ownership of those items kind of forevermore. And a lot of contracts do that. We want to make sure that our actors are protected from their images being used, especially with generative artificial intelligence going forward, where they can use one image and create a whole identity based upon that individual's image, voice, and that's just not right.
Here's the other problem, though, when you're talking with artificial intelligence and taking an image or so, a company, if they wanted to, could take the image of a working actor or actress and create a digital duplicate of that person. And to avoid issues like your proposed law, they could just subtly alter that image just a little bit because it's in a computer. You can do whatever you want to with it. And could they skirt the law that way?
Well, there's always ways if someone wants to avoid, following the law, someone that's nefarious will find a way. But what this legislation will do, it'll actually require that in contrast between studios and actors that they actually account for that individual's image. It's just like the laws we have, the copyright laws for music. Right, they might change a note here or there, but if you can show that someone's musical intellectual property was used, you have the right to sue. And ultimately, those decisions will be made by a court of law. But if someone is, that dastardly to do that, then certainly, the courts will have to take that up.
Let's talk the nuts and bolts of making law. Is this bill, does it stand a chance? What's the support like in Sacramento?
There's no doubt that AI, we've even seen it from the governor, who's taking a close look at artificial intelligence in general and its impact on our economy. There's no doubt that this issue is getting more and more attention in Sacramento. Now, the likelihood of this bill being successful, we're going to find that out in the next few weeks and months ahead, as now that we put pen to paper, it's going to hopefully require and urge these studios to come to the table and actually have conversations with us, because the status quo is not good enough. We know that we have to protect individuals' image, likeness, voice to make sure that their rights are protected.
I mean, no one knows if the strike will still be going on, but if you were to succeed, this bill becomes a law, gets signed, goes into effect, does that take the issue off the table in the current contract negotiations between the actors and the studios?
Well, there might be some details that would still have to be negotiated. And what we hope is that it empowers the actors. And let's keep in mind, especially those small role actors, the big name actors, they're going to get what they want in contracts. It's those small role actors that we're really looking out for here, and commercial actors, what have you. We hope that if this is passed and becomes law, that it will empower the actors and require the studios to account for this in the contracts, because going forward, we don't know where the technology is going to take us. And so it will require this as part of the process of negotiation.
So, you know, the studios have a lot of lobbying, a lot of money, a lot of clout. Is this the kind of bill, Ash, that if they came to Sacramento and said, look, we'll be a little bit more malleable in our negotiations with our actors, but you guys just drop this talk of having legislation. We would rather there not be a law about it. We'll just deal with it. Is that in the cards?
Well, absolutely. We can expect for them to try to do that. But we're not here to do the bidding of these studios that literally make billions of dollars in profit because of the actors and the talent on the screen, not because of studio bosses. So I'm more than willing to sit down with the studios and have a constructive conversation. But if their goal is simply just to come up here to try to kill our efforts to delve into this issue, then I think they're going to fail.
All right. Democratic Assemblymember, thank you for joining us. Ash Kalra from San Jose.
And a little bit later, can lawsuits stop climate change? You know, like we're going to sue the earth or whatever. we'll talk to an attorney who's taking on big oil to help save the planet. So he's going to sue oil, not the planet.
Oil itself.
Right. Yes.
Because suing Mother Nature, you don't want to do.
No, because Mother Nature has a big law firm behind her.
That's right. Yeah. Right now, though, if you are headed to Las Vegas today or the next day or so, and you're planning to stay at an MGM hotel on the Strip, you might run into some problems. The hotels have been hit with a massive cyber attack. It's caused some major issues. Rick Velotta is the assistant business editor for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
So the story I heard is that the cyber attack hit so hard that people using room keys couldn't get into the rooms. It knocked out even that system. Is that correct?
That's correct. In the early going of this this incident, the people were complaining that they were not able to access their rooms because they used the MGM app, which has the ability to open the door. What MGM has now done, though, is they have issued the common room key with the card room keys that kind of take the place of that app. So that seems to be back in order on all the MGM properties. And incidentally, this is not just one place. It's like 10 different resorts on the Las Vegas Strip.
Any idea who's doing the hacking?
Well, right now we are reporting that a Russian ransomware hacker group known as ALPHV, A-L-P-H-V, and they also go by Black Cat. That's who we're hearing is responsible for this, but MGM has not acknowledged that it's even been an attack or a cyber attack. They are saying that it's an incident that they are working to correct. And even though it has affected a number of different computer systems, including all the corporate email, some slot machines, the paid parking system that they have, a number of different systems have been affected by this, but they are trying to regain control of some of these things. One of the things that's kind of interesting is that because they don't want to spread this to other systems, they've actually shut some of the things down themselves and just to make sure that it doesn't continue onward to other systems within the company.
And has this ever happened to any other hotel chain there in Vegas? Has ransomware hit it? And what happened? Did they pay?
Well, we have been checking out some reports right now. The gaming regulators are not confirming anything. But apparently this has happened to another large Las Vegas company, Caesars Entertainment. We are reaching out to them to see if they want to talk a little bit about it. There are numerous reports on the internet that suggest that they did pay a ransom, but we have not confirmed any of that.
You mentioned a Russian group. Is there any reason to believe that it would be state-sponsored?
No indication of that. It sounds like these are just independent folks that like to stir up trouble and try to ransom, get paid for some of the to correct some of the things that they've done to the systems. Apparently, some of the experts that we've talked to said that this breach might have been made with just a simple telephone call that lasted 10 minutes. That they found some passwords that were necessary to access the system. They got in, and then they created havoc.
Were they able to access personal information, like if someone had stayed at an MGM property in Vegas and they had to input, you know, names, addresses, what have you, would that be in there?
The company has not acknowledged that any personal data has been breached. But, of course, that's always something that you need to watch out for. When part of the system that was attacked is the credit card system. So, obviously, there's a lot of personal information attached to some of these credit card accounts. If that information was breached, then there could be problems for the public. But at the present time, there's no indication that that has occurred.
How often does this happen in Vegas, and how often do we know about it?
Well, we know of at least three incidents in like the past, I believe, year. There was one incident that was reported in August that looked like it was going to be a cyber attack, but in fact, it was not. It was, in fact, a construction company that was working that sliced one of the fiber optic lines that supplied Westgate Resorts. That turned out to be not a cyber attack, and they were back online within 24 hours.
All right, Rick Villada, thank you so much for joining us. That was he's assistant business editor for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Hacking the MGM hotels, all the properties, got into the systems, locked people out of the rooms, couldn't park the cars, couldn't buy stuff.
You're listening to KNX In Depth. That was a pregnant pause.
That was very pregnant.
It's very theatrical. You're listening, pause, to KNX In Depth. With Rob Archer, I'm Charles Feldman.
I had a baby.
You what?
As baby boomers get older, many are finding it harder and harder to get by. A lot of them are falling into homelessness as they age.
And this is becoming a growing problem that might not have an end in sight. Teresa Smith is CEO of Dreams for Change, which is a San Diego-based organization. It helps homeless people. It is a crisis that she sees up close. Teresa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So baby boomers, why, as they age, are they more prone to becoming homeless?
Well, partly because what we're seeing is that they're on a fixed income. And as we see inflation and the cost of housing skyrocketed, their income doesn't change. And so they cannot cover that difference of cost when the rent goes up, even if it is $50, $100, $200.
And these are endemic weaknesses in the social safety net that's supposed to help people. But a lot of that's been going away, especially as we see on the top end, people are getting richer and the middle class is disappearing. Is this all part of this? Is this just another symptom of that?
It most definitely is. But even more so, it's a bigger symptom of our housing situation and the increased cost of rent. You know, as you mentioned, the safety net hasn't really changed much. You know, they may get a $50 increase a year, but the rent goes up $200. Food costs goes up, you know, even more so too. So yeah, there's definitely that gap is widened even more so.
And I think we're right in saying that you think it's going to get worse, and I can see why you might think that, because all the conditions that we've just talked about are certainly not headed in the right direction in terms of rent increases, cost of inflation, that sort of thing. Is there a solution? Because it would be nice if we can tell people that there is, but we also want to be honest with them if there isn't.
Well, we already know what the solution is. A lot of it has to do with more housing. And as we talk about seniors, it's specific to senior housing. As you know, the baby boomers, in essence, are aging and moving into, you know, those later ages of life, the stages of life, the actual levels of senior housing to support that is just not available. And so as we can increase even just that stock of housing to give people that access.
Right. But the thing, you're right. But here's the thing, though, Teresa. I mean, you know, on homelessness across the board, whether it's baby boomers or younger people, you know, this mantra that people have been saying now for a very long time, especially in California, we need more housing. We need more affordable housing, right? And I see new housing going up all the time here in Los Angeles, but none of it would be considered even remotely reasonably priced unless you have a six-figure income. So that housing is not going to help the people that we're talking about. Do you see, other than just having a wish list, which is, you know, it's nice to wish, but do you see any real progress in the years that you've been dealing with this in the direction that it would take in order to solve, or at least start to solve, this problem?
Not the progress that we need, by no means. But yeah, there isn't that progress that's happening. Because as you mentioned, some of the housing that's going up is unaffordable for most. And what we even see here in San Diego, a lot of it sits empty. So that doesn't help us at all when it gets to sit, when it just sits empty. So yeah, we're not keeping up with the pace by any means. And, you know, as I look to the future, because, you know, I've been working in this for quite a few years, that it's tough that we don't have an end in sight in so many ways. Tough to see that, tough to realize that, because the investment that needs to happen is just not there. And that's why I think there's other models that are looking at, because we know to build housing, it takes time. We can't necessarily build ourselves out of this as quickly. So I know there's groups that have been exploring some, what, you know, in essence, is consider that basic income, where how do we supplement our seniors specifically, because there's a project here in San Diego that's working specifically with seniors, by just giving them a couple hundred dollars a month, the $200 to $300 is possibly that rent increase that they experience, or that food cost that they experience. And helping them hopefully stay in the housing that they're in, just by giving them that actual cash to do that. And what we know from doing that too is that it's much cheaper to do that than it is for them to fall into homelessness and have to go through that homeless system where it's very costly.
Teresa, very quickly, this is obviously not sustainable. I don't think you think this is sustainable. You don't see a very bright light at the end of the table, at the end of the tunnel. But at some point, we're going to crash, aren't we? It's like we're talking about climate change, where the less and less we do, the worse it's going to get. And at some point, we pass the point of no return. Do you think we pass that point of no return? At some point, too many people are going to be unable to afford housing.
I don't think we're past that yet. I do think we still have time to make some changes and to help, you know, at least stop the bleed, and hopefully we can level out. And like I said, it is doing some of those types of things of just putting money in people's hands so they can stay in the house that they're at. Looking at policies around how we build. And I think, you know, I know our state has been doing better at that, looking at the legislation around how do we speed up the permitting processes so it doesn't take 2 years just to go through a permit process to build something. So I do think there is different leverages that we can utilize that will help. Because I it's not full of no hope, let me put it that way.
All right. Thank you so much. That is Teresa Smith, CEO of Dreams for Change. That's a San Diego-based organization helping homeless people.
You know, when I was younger, Rob, I used to want to sue for everything. And I'm not even a lawyer. You know,
right.
I was a kid. If the candy bar was melted, sue.
Right.
You know, or if my bicycle broke, you know, or the tire deflated.
Yeah.
Take a
chain came off. Sue.
Yeah. Because that, in my mind, was the way to settle things.
Yeah.
But it usually doesn't work.
No. Not always.
No.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are good reasons to do that. And attorney Jeffrey Simon may have one of them. He has been fighting big corporations for years and years, and he's won, too, making Big Pharma pay for its role in the opioid epidemic, for example.
And right now he's going after Big Oil for its role in climate change. Now he's with us to explain this massive lawsuit. He's also coming up with a new book tomorrow called Last Rights, The Fight to Save the Seventh Amendment. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
So I gather that this is very similar to suing Big Pharma for its role in the opioid epidemic in much the same way, is it not? You're suing Big Oil for what it's doing to add to climate change to make it worse. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. That's a very astute point. In in opioid litigation, the primary thesis was that certain pharmaceutical companies created a big public health crisis in violation of the law, and that is the same central allegation in the climate case we filed on behalf of Multnomah County, Oregon, against different companies, in this case, you know, fossil fuel companies.
So what would the remedy be?
Well, when one sues for public nuisance, what you are seeking is money for harm reduction. In other words, Portland, Oregon, which is in Multnomah County, is not Phoenix, and it's not planned in terms of, you know, urban strategies for heat resilience. And that's because the average high temperature, you know, for 1,000 years in that part of the world in the summer was 78 degrees. Well, in June 2021, Multnomah County, Oregon, and along with the entire Pacific Northwest of the United States, was hit with the most extreme heat event in recorded history. Temperatures reached 116 degrees Fahrenheit. 1,000 people died in the region. Things burned. Property was destroyed. The cables and cable cars melted. And in order to deal with the fact that that's going to happen over and over again, the entire infrastructure has to be reimagined in terms of heat resilience and emergency services. And it's very expensive. And the companies that caused that should have to pay for it. And there are a number of published scientific studies that says this event was caused by carbon pollution, principally fossil fuels.
And therein lies part of the problem, I think. As you say, Big Oil has a lot of money and they could pay for fixing a lot of this. But they also want to use that money to protect themselves. So they're going to throw a lot of money at you. They have a big lobby as well. They have a lot of politicians in their pocket, not just Republicans, but Democrats as well. And now in government, you have a noticeable subset of politicians who are right there with the climate change deniers who say that there might be climate change happening, but it's not man-made and it's certainly not the fault of Big Oil. So you've got a lot of headwinds against you. How are you dealing with that?
Well, you're absolutely right. But this is a matter of straightforward, irrefutable science. Denying that fossil fuel pollution is causing extreme weather in various places around the world is like denying the existence of gravity. It is as clear in science that the fossil fuel essentially blocking structure. In other words, the carbon molecules in the atmosphere prevent refracted heat from escaping the Earth's surface, which causes it to warm, which throws the heat energy balance of the world out of balance and causes extreme heat events. Simply put, the world, the surface temperature of the Earth is a little more than 3 degrees warmer than it should be because of fossil fuels. And that might not sound very much if you're talking about the difference between 72 and 75 degrees on a particular day, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the surface temperature of the Earth. It would be like if my standard temperature going forward, the new normal, instead of being 98.6, was 101.6. Well, then I'm sick. And not only that, if I then get sick with something else that raises my temperature, you know, now I'm at 104, 105, I can have a heat stroke. That is what has happened to the Earth. And that scientific fact is undeniable.
Right. Jeffrey, let me read you a little bit of what some of the oil companies are saying, right? We reached out, for example, to ExxonMobil. We didn't hear back from them. But a lawyer for Chevron told a TV station in Oregon that these lawsuits are counterproductive. They're distractions from advancing international policy solutions, and a spokesperson for Shell told that same station that the company fully supports, and we're quoting, the need for society to transition to a low-carbon future, but that a lawsuit is not the best way to pursue that goal. And I take it that you are going to find all of those statements objectionable.
I certainly find them entirely inapplicable.
Okay.
If a company pollutes and as a result of that pollution they harm people in a community at large, then they should be held accountable in the civil justice system, especially if they lie about what they foresaw as the intended impact of that pollution, and we contend that they did. In this lawsuit, we can't change regulatory policy or even the minds of politicians necessarily, nor are we trying to. What we're trying to do is hold what we contend is a group of wrongdoers accountable for the harm they caused, which is no different than any other appropriate use of the civil justice system.
All right, Jeffrey Simon, thank you so much. He is at the head of a lawsuit, a big lawsuit, going after big oil for its role in climate change.
You know, I'm starting to regret that when I was a kid and the chocolate bar melted, I didn't sue.
You should have.
I should have.
You could have gone somewhere.
I could have. At least I could have gotten another chocolate bar.
Right, exactly.
And I didn't.
And hey, a new chocolate bar is not nothing.
Yeah, so I lost all around.
That's going to do it for KNX In Depth today. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll get some more lawsuits from Charles Feldman over here, and we'll see you then.
You know, when I was younger, Rob, I used to want to sue for everything, and I'm not even a lawyer. You know,
right.
I was a kid, if the candy bar was melted, sue!
Right.
If my bicycle broke, you know, where the tire deflated.
Yeah.
Take it
chain
to the court.
Came off. Sue.
Yeah. Because that, in my mind, was the way to settle things.
Yeah.
But it usually doesn't work.
No. Not always.
No.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are good reasons to do that. And attorney Jeffrey Simon may have one of them. He has been fighting big corporations for years and years. And he's won, too, making big pharma pay for its role in the opioid epidemic, for example.
And right now he's going after big oil for its role in climate change. Now he's with us to explain this massive lawsuit. He's also coming up with a new book tomorrow called Last Rights, The Fight to Save the Seventh Amendment. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
So I gather that this is very similar to suing Big Pharma for its role in the opioid epidemic in much the same way. Is it not? You're suing Big Oil for what it's doing to add to climate change to make it worse. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. That's a very astute point. In opioid litigation, the primary thesis was that certain pharmaceutical companies created a big public health crisis in violation of the law, and that is the same central allegation in the climate case we filed on behalf of Multnomah County, Oregon, against different companies, in this case, you know, fossil fuel companies.
So what would the remedy be?
Well, when one sues for public nuisance, what you are seeking is money for harm reduction. In other words, Portland, Oregon, which is in Multnomah County, is not Phoenix, and it's not planned in terms of, you know, urban strategies for heat resilience. And that's because the average high temperature, you know, for 1,000 years in that part of the world in the summer was 78 degrees. Well, in June 2021, Multnomah County, Oregon, and along with the entire Pacific Northwest of the United States, was hit with the most extreme heat event in recorded history. Temperatures reached 116 degrees Fahrenheit. 1,000 people died in the region. Things burned. Property was destroyed. The cables and cable cars melted. And in order to deal with the fact that that's going to happen over and over again, the entire infrastructure has to be reimagined in terms of heat resilience and emergency services, and it's very expensive, and the companies that cause that should have to pay for it, and there are a number of published scientific studies that says this event was caused by carbon pollution, principally fossil fuels.
And therein lies part of the problem, I think. As you say, Big Oil has a lot of money, and they could pay for fixing a lot of this. But They also want to use that money to protect themselves, so they're going to throw a lot of money at you. They have a big lobby as well. They have a lot of politicians in their pocket, not just Republicans, but Democrats as well. And now in government, you have a noticeable subset of politicians who are right there with the climate change deniers who say that there might be climate change happening, but it's not man-made, and it's certainly not the fault of big oil. So you've got a lot of headwinds against you. How are you dealing with that?
Well, you're absolutely right. But this is a matter of straightforward, irrefutable science. Denying that fossil fuel pollution is causing extreme weather in various places around the world is like denying the existence of gravity. It is as clear in science that the fossil fuel essentially blocking structure. In other words, the carbon molecules in the atmosphere prevent refracted heat from escaping the Earth's surface, which causes it to warm, which throws the heat energy balance of the world out of balance and causes extreme heat events. Simply put, the world, the surface temperature of the Earth is a little more than 3 degrees warmer than it should be because of fossil fuels. And that might not sound very much if you're talking about the difference between 72 and 75 degrees on a particular day, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the surface temperature of the Earth. It would be like if my standard temperature going forward, the new normal, instead of being 98.6, was 101.6. Well, then I'm sick. And not only that, if I then get sick with something else that raises my temperature, you know, now I'm at 104, 105, I can have a heat stroke. That is what has happened to the Earth. And that scientific fact is undeniable.
Right. Jeffrey, read you a little bit of what some of the oil companies are saying, right? We reached out, for example, to ExxonMobil. We didn't hear back from them. But a lawyer for Chevron told a TV station in Oregon that these lawsuits are counterproductive. They're distractions from advancing international policy solutions, and a spokesperson for Shell told that same station that the company fully supports, and we're quoting, the need for society to transition to a low-carbon future, but that a lawsuit is not the best way to pursue that goal. And I take it that you are going to find all of those statements objectionable.
I certainly find them entirely inapplicable.
Okay.
If a company pollutes, and as a result of that pollution, they harm people in a community at large, then they should be held accountable in the civil justice system, especially if they lie about what they foresaw as the intended impact of that pollution, and we contend that they did. In this lawsuit, we can't change regulatory policy or even the minds of politicians necessarily, nor are we trying to. What we're trying to do is hold what we contend is a group of wrongdoers accountable for the harm they caused, which is no different than any other appropriate use of the civil justice system.
All right, Jeffrey Simon, thank you so much. He is at the head of a lawsuit, a big lawsuit, going after big oil for its role in climate change.
You know, I'm starting to regret that when I was a kid and the chocolate bar melted, I didn't sue.
You should have.
I should have.
You could have gone somewhere.
I could have. At least I could have gotten another chocolate bar.
Right, exactly.
And I didn't.
And hey, a new chocolate bar is not nothing.
Yeah, so I lost all around.
That's going to do it for KNX in Depth today. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll get some more lawsuits from Charles Feldman over here, and we'll see you then.